dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we are privileged to tap each week, and I mean that in the sense of gray matter in the head rather than classified information, is David Goldman. He is best known perhaps for his extraordinarily incisive analyses and commentaries in a column he writes under the nom de plume of Spengler at Asia Times. He's also the author of How Nations Die. He is a voluble contributor to our understanding of some of the most important topics, particularly in the economic realm, but also geostrategic ones. And I'm so proud of our association with him and pleased to have him back. David, welcome.
I'm equally proud to be associated with you, Frank. Thank you.
Well, one of the most important, I think, manifestations of that wonderful partnership is that you are a member of this new Committee on the Present Danger, China, that we unveiled on Monday of this week. And David, I want to thank you for rogering up to that. You bring an enormous amount of knowledge about China. In fact, you've written with, I think, considerable, although normal for you, effect about China's plan for global supremacy, as seen from yourself as somewhat of an insider, having monitored and been involved in China for a long time. Tell us about that plan and its imminence.
There are 2 billion people in the global South who are up for grabs. They're underemployed, they're undercapitalized, they're poor, and China wants to transform all those countries, not just Southeast Asia, its backyard, but also Latin America, Mexico, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, into economic satrapies of China, make them zombie economies that are completely dependent on Chinese technology, Chinese software, Chinese financing, and the Chinese market, which would give them a stranglehold on the world economy and an insuperable strategic position. And they hope to do this by 2035. If we sit back and let them do it, we're going to end up being turned into a second-rate power the way Britain was in the course of the 20th century. I don't think we want that to happen.
Yeah, the world shouldn't want that to happen. But isn't it correct to say that it's not just the southern part of the globe that they're focused on? They're also quite ambitiously pursuing areas to the north of the equator, Central Asia, of course, the areas of even Europe that they've been making inroads into as well.
No. Oh. Xi Jinping just turned up in Italy, and Italy signed on to membership in their Belt and Road Initiative, which is the $2 trillion umbrella operation, which the Chinese have advanced as the vehicle for asserting their world economic dominance. From the standpoint of Italy, which is in a deep financial crisis, loaded in debt, a sclerotic economy, they're looking at the Chinese as an economic savior. Now, I don't think they may really end up liking it as much if they end up in bed with the Chinese as they think. But they certainly moved in that direction. And that's the first member of the group of seven, first core NATO member that's gone over to the other side. So things are not going in our direction. And that's why the Committee on the Present Danger, which you and Brian Kennedy took the lead in founding. So, kudos for that, is so important now.
Well, thank you. The thing I wanted to emphasize in what you just said, two things really. One is it's $2 trillion, not billion, $1 trillion they're investing in this Belt and Road Initiative. And they have, it seems, begun the process of converting this very important strategically as well as, politically important NATO ally into one of their satrapies. I have to say, I have a friend who has done a lot of business in and with the Italians, and he said, don't count on them going the distance with the Chinese, and they shouldn't either. But the problem is, as you've said on this program and elsewhere, David Goldman, once they've got their hooks in you, you may not find it easy to get away. Let me switch to a different topic, if I can, quickly. The president this week made a breathtakingly important announcement, I think, in terms of recognizing reality with respect to Israel's sovereign control of, and indeed their annexation, of the highlands of the Golan Heights. David, talk a little bit about the importance of that. We're hearing now from the Syrians and the Iranians and the Turks that they're very upset about this, and it may even go beyond just denunciations. But why is this important, as you see it, and what likely will be the consequence of this action?
Well, there's a short-term and a long-term aspect, Frank. Short-term, Syria is being turned into an Iranian colony through the murder of 500,000 Syrians by the Assad regime and the displacement of 10 million Syrians who are being replaced by Iranian-controlled settler militias. This is an ethnic cleansing colonization program to turn Syria into essentially part of Iran. So the Golan Heights, which towers over Israel, which Israel took in the Six-Day War, were that to remain in Syrian hands, it would basically be an Iranian military platform, and it's out of the question that Israel could give it up. So best to simply say, we're not accepting Iran's attempt to transform Syria into its salient to the Mediterranean against Israel.
And by the way, we should say that the Iranian forces are on the other side of the Golan, poised to move against Israel, were it actually, you know, against all logic to relinquish that territory. So this isn't just an academic question.
If you stand on the Golan, you can virtually spit into anywhere in northern Israel.
Or shoot, more to the point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sniper rifle could command, you know, a good part of territory, let alone a cannon. But the longer-term issue, more fundamentally, is the Arabs have to understand that if you keep starting wars and you refuse to make peace, eventually you're going to pay a penalty for that. And if there isn't any penalty paid, and the penalty means loss of territory, no one is going to come to the negotiating table. So if you want peace, you have to make the losing side admit that it's lost. And that means loss of territory.
I'm so glad you said this.
You know, land for peace is fine as long as it means less land for less peace.
Right. That has to be part of the equation. Daniel Pipes has done a wonderful job with his Middle East Forum arguing for precisely this point.
A close friend of mine, I was for several years a fellow at Forum.
Yeah, well, it's really such a sensible approach that we start any peace process from the perspective that Israel won the last war. Well, several of them, for thank God, for land, among other purposes. David, we have to leave it at that. I thank you so much for your time today, as always, and I look forward to talking with you again in the near future. Next up, we will be speaking with Joe DeGeneva about President Trump's splendid speech in Grand Rapids last night and the prospects for holding accountable those who have perpetrated the collusion delusion. That and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined by the great Joe DeGeneva. He is these days a partner, the founding partner, in fact, of the law firm of DeGeneva and Tensing. But his record of public service extends for decades, including as a U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, as a special counsel on various scandals, and chief counsel and staff director for several U.S. Senate committees, a man who knows his way around both investigations and special counsel work and the like. And you've seen him a lot at Fox and elsewhere. He is an extraordinary resource on what has just gone down. And We're catching up with Joe, of course, in the immediate aftermath of an extraordinary speech by the president in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in which he addressed these issues very forcefully and in some cases rather colorfully. Joe DeGeneva, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Delighted.
So the president has come out swinging, I think it's fair to say, to these vast numbers of supporters in Michigan. He called what went down, quote, an elaborate hoax, unquote, and announced that the, quote, collusion delusion is over, unquote. You've probably done as much as anybody, certainly in the non-governmental sector, Joe, to really dissect what's been going on here. And I'd like to get your professional assessment of the Mueller investigation and its results.
Well, thank you. First of all, this was not a complicated matter from the very beginning. It's been relatively apparent that there was, in fact, no collusion whatsoever, because there's never been any reported evidence of it, notwithstanding all the articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post. It all began on July 5th, 2016, when James Comey illegally exonerated Hillary Clinton from her crimes under the Espionage Act. That day marked the beginning of a very, very serious deterioration of U.S. federal law enforcement, both at the FBI, the Department of Justice, and in the intelligence community. It was very apparent to anyone who was a seasoned law enforcement official that Hillary Clinton had violated the law, that she should have been prosecuted, not necessarily jailed, but she should have been charged with a crime and made to plead guilty or go to trial. After that, it also became abundantly clear after this Russian hoax thing came out, after the election, that a plan was afoot to purposely exonerate her at the highest levels of the FBI and Obama Justice Department, and then to figure out a way to frame Donald Trump if he weren't elected. I think it's pretty clear now that crimes were committed by senior DOJ officials in terms of FBI and CIA people and National Security Council people at the White House under Obama, that included unmasking of individuals in violation of the espionage statutes, the leaking of their names to the press, and the leaking of contents of telephone conversations to the press. These are very serious felonies, and they will be investigated by Attorney General Barr. I think one of the most fascinating parts of this story is a little-known email that Susan Rice drafted to herself Inauguration Day 2017, where she memorializes a January 5th meeting with President Obama, Vice President Biden, everybody in the intelligence community hierarchy, and everybody in the law enforcement hierarchy from FBI and DOJ, in which they discuss the Russian attacks on our cyber system and also discuss how President Obama said he knew that everything had been done, quote, by the book, end quote. Now, that email to the record by Susan Rice is the evidence, the first part of the evidence, that President Obama was aware of everything that went on in this phony espionage investigation of President Trump and his associates. It is a perfect beginning for a grand jury, which needs to be impaneled.
Yeah. And Joe, I guess what you're saying there is that Susan Rice was trying to cover her own butt, if I can use that colloquial expression. But in the course of it is really implicating not only herself, but the President of the United States in this extraordinary conspiracy to abuse various federal powers and authorities. You mentioned unmasking as an example, not only to protect Hillary Clinton, but also to interfere with the election in 2016 and subsequently the transition of the president-elect.
You're absolutely correct. I have always been struck by the stupidity of that email, which Susan Rice drafted for the record on January 20th, literally at about 12:15 of Inauguration Day. Just picture yourself. There she is in the White House.
Beavering away at her computer.
This is a movie. But what is so fascinating about it is, but for that email, we do not know about the January 5th meeting in the White House with President Obama, Loretta Lynch, James Comey, Clapper, Brennan, Sally Yates, and others. And the vice president was there. So if she doesn't write that email, we don't know about that meeting. This was really stupid. And it was, in fact, what you have just said. This was to protect her. This did not protect President Obama or anybody. This creates a horrible legal problem for the President of the United States.
And I suspect for her, too, at the end of the day.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, yes, of course. But as I said, if I'm conducting a grand jury, that's the first witness.
Yeah, amen. So, Joe, I wish you very much to be the guy conducting the grand jury, by the way. That would be wonderful, if you don't mind, one more time. Listen, just again, a professional assessment here. There is now pretty clear evidence that the prosecutions, of which there were many by Bob Mueller, had nothing to do with collusion, and in fact, didn't have much to do with anything other than apparently tripping people up on sort of perjury charges for false statements, some of which may have been quite inadvertent, like I think was the case with Mike Flynn. Tell us about that.
Well, I think what that does is show that the basis for the Mueller probe was always ill-founded, that there was no basis for it, that Mueller knew that very early on in the probe that there was no basis for it because he had no intelligence community intercepts or emails that showed that there was collusion. And he knew that within the first 90 days of being appointed. So the question becomes, why did he continue the investigation? And why did he bring a bunch of bunko squad type charges against Michael Flynn, Papadopoulos? He never charged Carter Page, which to me is such an outrageous thing that they used Carter Page the way they did to fake this this counterintelligence probe. So I think when all is said and done, I think Mueller's probe is disgraceful in its origin, disgraceful in its operation, and disgraceful in its conclusion. And I mean by that, not that he exonerated the president, which he had to, on Russian collusion, but that he refused to exonerate the president on obstruction, knowing full well that the president could not obstruct justice and did not. And I think his failure to say that is an insult to the process and a shame on his record. It is a horrible blemish on Bob's record.
And it's an invitation, of course, to continuing this hectoring of the president and trying to sabotage his presidency. Let me just ask you, Joe, and I don't know if you've given much thought to this, but it seems to me there's a glaring hole in a lot of the commentary and, well, for that matter, the kind of effort that the president is calling for in terms of holding the perpetrators of what might be called the anti-Trump conspiracy accountable for what they've done here. And it's been addressed, interestingly enough, by a colleague of mine, and she published a new book with us at the Center for Security Policy Press. Her name is Diana West, and the title of the book is The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. And what she argues is that, you know, the missing piece here is, why did these people do what they did? Why did they go to the lengths of engaging in felonious activities to try to stop Donald Trump's candidacy and then ultimately, take down his presidency? And she concludes, Joe, and I'd be very interested if you haven't read it, but your thoughts on this, that what you were dealing with were people who were part of this sort of revolutionary enterprise in America, the globalist, if you will, socialist, in some cases, they've even copped to being communists in various places in their career. But they were motivated to stop this counter-revolutionary Donald Trump.
I don't think there's any doubt that when you look at the cast of characters from Susan Rice, John Brennan especially, on down, Sally Yates, what you have are literally revolutionaries, ideological revolutionaries of extreme leftism. It goes beyond socialism. These people want to destroy the United States of America. I believe that, as others have said recently, which I agree with, this was in fact a plot to subvert a presidential election for ideological reasons. It wasn't just that they feared that Trump might do this, that, and the other thing. They feared that this was going to be the death knell for their style of ideology and politics. And Trump has absolutely done precisely what they feared. He stopped the engine of Obama leftism and created a new counter-revolutionary force, which is Trumpism. And it believes in freedom, freedom of expression, free speech, And we are watching over the next, over the next couple of years as we go toward 2020, there's going to be an upsurge in violence against the president's representatives out in public making speeches. Antifa will reignite itself. College campuses are going to continue to be a place where conservatives are hit in the face, literally, physically. We are in a civil war in this country, an ideological civil war about ideas. And as much as the people at the Washington Post and the New York want to poo-poo that, and say that's nonsense, and talk about white supremacy, talk about people like me being conspiracy theorists. The real conspiracy theorists are the people who refuse to believe that there was, in fact, a conspiracy against the president of the United States. It is now clear, beyond any doubt, that the ideological leftists almost succeeded in destroying a presidency, but they failed. And the reason is very simple. God's always on the side of the good people.
Well, let us pray that he continues to be so. Joe, I pray that we will, among other things, see Robert Barr pursue this inquiry as you think he will. And as I say, pray that you will be part of it. But in the event, I hope you'll come back to us and keep the commentary going. Thank you so much for what you do and your wonderful wife. Keep it up. We'll talk with you soon. Well, welcome back doesn't really begin to describe my excitement about this segment. My friend and colleague of many years, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, is in the house virtually. We're able to visit with him, it gives me tremendous pleasure to say, in the aftermath of the president's issuance of an executive order aimed at addressing a problem that Peter Pry has probably done more than any single individual for decades to try to make sure we understood, we were on notice that we needed to act about, and then to get specific steps taken to fix, namely our vulnerability to a phenomenon known as electromagnetic pulse. The truth is, this could happen to us at any time as a result either of enemy action or naturally occurring powerful geomagnetic storms. And I want to take this opportunity to thank Peter Pry from the bottom of my heart for this executive order, which I think, again, it's no exaggeration to say, without his hard work and that of many others, but most of whom were informed, as I was, by him and staffed in many cases by him, this executive order, this understanding of the danger, this call by the President of the United States for corrective action would not have happened. So, Peter Pry, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much, Frank, for that generous introduction. You have played no small role yourself in this, but I think I need to give the palm to Dr. William Graham, you know, my boss on the EMP Commission. After all, I was still in elementary school when he was discovering the EMP phenomena during the 62 Starfish Prime event. I've been honored to hold his coat in this long struggle toward national EMP preparedness.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't want to take anything away from him or members of Congress who you've worked with as well, or, you know, Jim Woolsey, who you've also worked with. But I think the common denominator in all of these things, and I believe every single one of these people, Roscoe Bartlett, Kurt Weldon, and others would say they couldn't have done what they did, including Dr. Graham, without your strong hand. And it wasn't just holding their coat. You were actually enabling much of what they did. So again, congratulations. Let's talk about the executive order, Peter. As it happens, I was on Breitbart Radio this morning talking with Alex Marlowe, and he led off the interview by describing his experience yesterday, which I think was replicated probably in many cases by even more horrific experiences, with the overturned tractor trailer tanker on the Beltway in Washington, D.C., that brought the city in what's known as, I guess, carpocalypse to a screeching halt for something on the order of 13 hours. I don't know if you were afflicted. I'm out of town myself. But this was a small, you know, sort of inkling, really, of what could happen if an EMP went down and stopped traffic or stopped telecommunications or stopped all of the rest of the critical infrastructure that depends on electricity. So give us a little bit of the flavor of that quickly, and then we'll talk about why this executive order is so needed and hopefully going to be helpful.
Sure. People could also look at what's going on right now in Venezuela, where they've only had blackouts for a few days, and people are already drinking from the sewers because there's no running water. And that's one of the things that would kill a lot of people, the fact that there'd be no running water immediately after an EMP, because you need vast amounts of electricity to pump and purify the water. You know, food would start spoiling in 72 hours when the emergency generators run out, and that is the biggest threat, starvation. The EMP Commission calculated that if we had a nationwide blackout lasting a year, which would be likely in the event of one of these scenarios, you know, we could lose 90% of our population to starvation, disease, societal collapse, nuclear reactors going Fukushima and spreading radioactivity all everywhere, gas pipelines exploding, causing firestorms in cities and forest fires. And, of course, as you mentioned, you know, the massive failure of transportation, because there'd just be no gasoline and cars. In the case of a nuclear EMP, you know, many of them would be stopped right on the road because of the destruction of their electronics. So this is a
Let me just say, Peter Pry, you have not only documented all of this through your work with Bill Graham and the rest of the EMP Threat Commission for, what is it now, 16 or 17 years, but you've also written several really important books where people can find out much more about this, including Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, and Electric Armageddon. Peter Pry, the president has now been seized with this problem. He has issued this executive order. It sets out some timelines for the bureaucracy and the executive branch to begin doing a variety of things. They seem to me to be rather protracted, frankly, based on particularly the availability of the great work that you all have been doing in the EMP Commission. But what's the problem with this executive order as you see it, if any?
Well, first, I think it's a good, strong executive order. And on the whole, I think it's an excellent executive order. And I actually am pleased with the timelines, okay? You know, because you have to contrast that with what the Department of Homeland Security, what the Obama holdovers and deep staters in the Department of Homeland Security did in their DHS so-called national EMP strategy, which basically calls for studying the threat out to the year 2028 before they decide to do anything. You know, this, by contrast, this executive order, for example, right off the bat, 90 days, you know, the departments and agencies are on the hook to start actually moving toward a solution in 90 days. And then after that step, it's 180 days. I mean, this is a big improvement over what they wanted to do, which is spin their wheels. By the way, I've got an anecdote I'd like to share, because when I briefed President Trump, you arranged that when he was first running for president at the Iowa caucuses. Yes, that's right. And I explained to him, he wanted to know, you know, why was this existential threat? How could it be? He was just so astonished that the departments and agencies of the U.S. government, you know, couldn't get together and wouldn't get together to solve this problem, because nobody wanted it, this hot potato. And he said to me, I'll never forget this, he said, don't worry, when I'm elected president, we'll knock their heads together and get this fixed. And if you actually look at the executive order, that's actually exactly what it does. The executive order basically makes a whole-of-government solution that puts the White House in charge, and the White House is basically knocking their heads together to force them into what are fast timelines compared to what, you know, the DHS wanted to do, and to try to move us toward a solution.
These are important points. There were some timelines, as I recall, that, you know, set out a year or 18 months or, you know, something like that. But the point is, Peter, I think the most important, as I see it, development is the one you've just alluded to, that the White House, in the person of the president's national security advisor, John Bolton, and one of his key deputies, Will Happer, are in charge of well, as you say, knocking heads together if necessary to get this government going on the problem. And I did want to make sure we spend a little bit of time talking about what I believe is the key thing they're going to have to overcome in terms of head knocking, and that is the obstruction of certain individuals in key agencies that are charged with doing some of this work. And I think it's important for us to name names, Peter Pry. You've worked with or tried to work to counter the activities of the deep state in the Department of Energy, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Defense. Can you tell us who are the people that John Bolton and Will Happer, well, need, frankly, to get out of the way if the implementation of this presidential direction is going to be fulfilled, certainly in the time that's laid out in these orders?
Yes, and there are four people, I mean, that are basically misdirecting their entire institutions and agencies, and are among the most serious impediment to getting the country protected. Just four of these bureaucrats. One of them is Patricia Hoffman, who's over at the Department of Energy, and she's perhaps the worst. You know, she's been around through multiple administrations, you know, and is basically an EMP threat naysayer. You know, she is not an expert on these matters.
A denier.
She's got a degree in ceramics or something like that, and has too cozy a relationship with the electric power industry, you know, which is why in the Department of Energy, under her leadership in this area, has been an obstacle, not an asset, to trying to get the country protected. Under her is a guy named Bill Tedeschi, you know, who was, he actually served on the EMP Commission because we brought in all points of view. And Bill Tedeschi is one of these guys who, to use an analogy, would probably be arguing that a man never landed on the moon and it was all a hoax. And has a similar attitude toward EMP. He should go. Somebody like that shouldn't be the scientific expert over at DOE. You know, in the Department of Defense, Michael Kuliasha is supposed to be their big EMP expert. This guy's not an EMP expert. You know, he's an Obama holdover. He was personally responsible for destroying the EMP Commission because, you know, in the Obama administration, the nuclear EMP threat was politically incorrect. And he did everything to undermine us, and he'll do everything he can to stop this executive order from being successful. And Scott Backhouse at the Department of Homeland Security is another one who should go. They're trying to set him up as the guru over people who know far more. There are good people in government who want to solve this problem. The White House knows who they are. And those are the people that should be running the show, not this Scott Backhouse guy who basically has the Obama administration view on EMP2 and wants to do nothing about it.
All right, Peter Pry, we are out of time, I'm afraid, but let me simply say that I pray that John Bolton and Will Happer, his lieutenant in this area, and the rest of the White House and national security team are going to make full and very good use of your expertise, your insights, and your corporate memory, not least, on the problems that we face to date and the necessity and the means by which we can fix this most critical of critical infrastructures, the electric grid, pursuant to the president's important executive order. Peter, again, my hat's off to you for your great service, and I hope it's going to very much be continuing into the future. Next up, we're going to talk to my colleague Michael Waller at the Center for Security Policy about, among other things, the Southern Poverty Law Center and the new Committee on the Present Danger, China. Right after this.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Mike Waller. These days, he is the Vice President for Government Affairs at the Center for Security Policy. He has been around Washington for many, many years, many of those years spent focusing on, teaching about, and in various capacities, practicing the art of information operations, black art of political warfare and the like. He is a great asset, great resource, and I'm very pleased to be able to spend some time talking with him about a couple of issues he's following closely for us at the Center. Mike, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be back, Frank.
Well, I wanted to catch up with you, Mike, especially in the aftermath of the president's speech last night in Grand Rapids, Michigan, about what he's called for in terms of accountability for those who were engaged in promoting what he's called this elaborate hoax, prompting the so-called collusion delusion. He specifically mentioned several, including the thin-necked Adam Schiff. I wanted to get your thoughts, particularly about the role that Schiff has played in all of this, especially against the backdrop of this extraordinary letter from all of his Republican colleagues, led by Devin Nunes, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, calling for Schiff's resignation as chairman.
Well, yeah, until since the Intelligence Committee was founded in the 1970s, it has been the most bipartisan of all the committees in Congress. It's had to be. That's why it's a select committee to get the most responsible members from each party to oversee our intelligence community. And when Adam Schiff was the ranking Democrat on there and now the chairman, he was behind a huge leaking campaign to take national secrets that the committee was entrusted with and to leak them to the media to fight a political battle against Donald Trump. And so this terrible abuse of power is unprecedented for an Intelligence Committee chairman, and that's what prompted the very unusual or unique move of these House Republicans, every single member of the Intelligence Committee, to demand his resignation, even saying that he abused his constitutional authority.
Wow. Well, I hope that they will succeed in this mission. It's unlikely. And the reason this, we should be clear, this has been so politicized, is Nancy Pelosi deliberately put political hacks on that committee rather than, as you say, the best, certainly the most responsible and knowledgeable members. And the result's been absolutely predictable, a train wreck. Mike, I wanted to talk with you as well about this organization. Speaking of the black art of political warfare, it is one of the prime practitioners of it on behalf of the radical left and their, unlikely as it may seem, Sharia supremacist allies. And I'm talking, of course, about the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has spent an awful lot of time savaging our organization, me personally, and many others of us, claiming that we're conspiracy theorists and so on. I talked about this with Joe DeGeneva earlier in the program. But the organization seems to have come a cropper in a number of respects. Talk to us about what's going on at the so-called SPLC at the moment and what it says about the organization.
Well, think of this. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a slush fund of $500 million, much of it parked in offshore secret bank accounts. And you have people who were real victims of Ku Klux Klan violence who just needed some legal support, which is what the Southern Poverty Law Center was set up to provide, who got denied that legal support because the SPLC was hoarding more and more and more money. And then, according to its own supporters, was using scare tactics to frighten elderly people into shoveling more money into their secret bank accounts. So finally, this came to a head. And what we realized, what was exposed, was institutional racism inside the SPLC, where black people were discriminated against and called terrible names, not just once, but for decades. And women were being harassed and physically abused and so forth. And the real scandal is not that one or two leaders of the SPLC were this way, but that everybody at the SPLC seems to know. While at the same time, they're going around calling others racists and sexists and haters. So the SPLC sort of self-destructed. And when you get the New Yorker and these other liberal left,
Washington Post,
yeah, start thrashing in LA Times. Yeah, it's a sick operation that they've had going there. Have they been duping us?
And speaking of the New Yorker, this fellow Bob Moser, who was an employee of the Southern Poverty Law Center, called it, quote, a highly profitable scam, unquote. I mean, this really does take the cake, especially when they've been practicing the very things they're accusing other people without foundation, by the way, of doing simply because they are conservatives and they disagree with the SPLC's political agenda. Hey, Mike, speaking of which, I mentioned that the SPLC was joined at the hip in recent years with the Muslim Brotherhood and assorted front groups that it uses to run influence operations, political warfare, if you will, in the United States. You had a post at the Center for Security Policy's site, which is, of course, securefreedom.org, in which you talk about a U.S. Islamist leader who has essentially laid out proscribed terms in a lexicon that he has come up with, a list of words that include things like Islamist terrorism and jihadist and violent jihad and radical Islam and ban Sharia law. And Sharia is antithetical to the U.S. Constitution. He's essentially saying that we need to impose, now quite formally, Sharia blasphemy restrictions inside the United States. Tell us about this character and what we're to make of this new effort by a guy with Sharia supremacist credentials to silence us.
Oh, his whole place was his whole mosque. It's located in Northern Virginia. It's tied to the 9/11 hijackers.
This is the Dar al-Hijra Mosque in Fairfax, as I understand it.
Yes, it's a very dangerous collection of the worst operators in the whole United States, and they congregate there to run terrorist support operations and subversive Muslim Brotherhood activity in the nation's capital. And so here he is now posting on Facebook, this board member of the mosque, a former leader of a known Muslim Brotherhood front organization, coming out with this blasphemy list, which would effectively make anybody who uses the word jihad in a non-approved fashion or radical Islam or whatever, subject them to hate crimes for saying these things.
That's the point, is to turn this thing from just sort of a general encouragement to engage in self-censorship into a political basis for actual prosecution.
Right. We saw this, you and I both saw this right after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks where the Muslim Brotherhood groups congregated and they made it politically impossible for people in Washington to speak in certain terms, and therefore made it impossible for our national security community to come to grips with the nature of the Islamist problem in the United States, because they weren't free to use those words.
Yeah, this is so important. Our friend Steve Coughlin has done a wonderful slide for his PowerPoint briefing in which he shows the progression from the 9/11 Commission report through successive FBI and DHS, documents where those words have been simply struck from the lexicon, like, Sharia, jihad, and the like. And this is really dumbing down our understanding of the threat, isn't it, Mike? And I just wanted to sort of tie this together. The Muslim Brotherhood is, of course, behind much of this. They're not the only Sharia supremacists, but they're perhaps the most aggressive. There has been a call from our organization, among others, Mike, for their designation as the terrorist organization they are. Speak very briefly, if you could, but quickly and to the point of what this organization is doing to subvert and, if possible, through any means, to overthrow the government of the United States.
Muslim Brotherhood has been around more than 80 years, and they have the same end goals as Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which is to establish a jihadist Islamist caliphate on the entire world and repress everybody else. That's their goal. It's just they don't yet necessarily use terrorism explicitly. So they came out of the mosque dictating that it's forbidden for critics to say that Sharia is unconstitutional, precisely because it's a plot against the United States Constitution as the Muslim Brotherhood is implementing it here.
Mike, we are hard out of time. I just want to say thank you for the great work that you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.